hans.
Ja, hei Trond. Du. Ja.
Ja.
Ja. Ah. Båda lider.
Damplokomotiv, altså. Det bråka så jævlig med de damplokomotivene.
Det helt sjukt. Det ja, det veldig fint nivå, men det ganske fint å se på, da.
Ja, det det. Men du, ja. Hans, jeg synes det bikkje kaldt her. Kan ikke vi ta oss og gå inn?
Pingle. Ja, greit nok, vi sikker inn. Ja, det jo litt synd at du skal bytte ut de her fine lokomotivene her også, da. De fine togene, faktisk.
Ja, men det... Jeg kan skjønne det da, folk vil komme fort der frem, og det langt til Oslo, altså.
Det forbaskelig og så langt, altså 13 timer en stund.
Dessuten, damplokomotivene, de bråker jo fælt da. Men, skal vi se her, der døra, skal vi se her.
Ja. Ja, det var litt kaldt ute da, greit nok.
Ja, nei, men, skal vi se her, finne oss her. Plass og sett, ja. Det var jo veldig trivelig, litt av stue her.
Ja, det gjort ganske mye flid med stasjonen her i landet, så det må vi bare si.
Jeg hadde ikke trodd at det skulle være såpass pent på venterommet på Berkåk, men
ja,
det noe så...
Det helt rett i det, altså.
Men du, Hans,
ja.
Hvorfor er vi her?
Vi skal finne ut om de nye såkalte lyntogene, det NSB Diesel Express-settet, om det egentlig noe test i det hele tatt. Altså, vi har jo hørt at det skal gå raskere, vi har hørt at det skal være mer komfortabelt. NSB spyr ut propaganda om at dette skal være... tingen. Men særlig.
Usikker, ja. Nei, jeg kjenner igjen. Men altså, jeg så glad i de gamle damplokomotivene, ikke sant?
Ja.
Det for det første, så har de ordentlig spisevogn.
Ja, det en viktig greie, altså.
Ordentlig kjøkken, det på en måte, man kan liksom aldri færre ut og reise uten å ha et ordentlig kjøkken.
Nei, det går
ikke.
Det
blir veldig dumt. Det har du liksom, bare eksempelvis her, jeg var for et par år siden, var ute og reise, fikk lammekoteletter på toget, ypperlig. Kunne også ha fått med en 4-retters middag, men...
Ja, jeg testet den siste jeg var ute og reise, den var veldig bra, den turen der, altså.
Ikke sant, og du har en ordentlig vogn, ikke sant, der det ikke for tett, og du har god betjening som tar deg... betjeningen blir jo ikke byttet ut, men jeg litt engstelig for at når de begynner med de her dieseltogene, altså, for at det er ikke så god plass, det liksom mer for allmuen, de her togene.
Ja, det er ikke bra det, altså.
Nei, så nei, vi får se det. Men, altså,
vi får se, de må ha noe mat og noe slag, altså 7 timer her nå, halvparten av 13, men uansett, det
Ja, nei, men... Så det sånn, jeg skal ikke sku huden på hårene, skal ikke det?
Men, nei, men allikevel, det jeg er litt forutsatt for det her, altså. Dette ja. her det har vi ikke stor tro på, egentlig.
Skeptisk. Ja, men du, Hans, den tenker jeg har lurer litt på. For at i veldig mye ut av denne litteraturen som vi driver og leser på, både innenfor horror og spøkelse og innenfor krim, så er det jo veldig sånn vanlig at man enten så er man på en annen plass enn sin egen heim. Det skjer jo aldri at man blir hjemsøkt av spøkelser i sin egen heim.
Nei, det er jo noe med det at man er utrygg blant det fremmede. Altså for eksempel så den her sære fyren som stod i skygge på perrongen der, eller?
Ja, jeg tror det er ordføreren.
Oi faen.
Ja, han kommer ned, så, men det sto i aviser, skjønner du. Han kommer ned her, og så ser han på toget hver dag. Han har visst nok en eller annen merkelig greie for damplokomotiv.
Han så jo skikkelig sær ut.
Ja. Nei, men altså, det,
uansett, ja, det noe med det at man ikke på hjemstedet sitt, da, som gjør at man føler seg utrygg og litt utblått fremmede folk, og vet ikke hvem disse folka er.
Ja, men kjenner jo igjen den, altså. Nå er det jo greit, jeg har jo deg med her, og klart, vi er jo ikke så langt unna Trondheim, det er jo bare...
Enda?
Nei da, men vi skal jo bare tilbake igjen, når damplokomotivet...
Sant, ja. Skulle vært i Oslo natt, og tenk om det er særhotellet vi kunne kommet inn på.
Ja, det er jo stilig. Oslo, jeg har vært der et par ganger, men det begynner å bli et par år siden nå.
Jeg har vært der en del ganger, ja, men jeg har jo venner og generelt bekjente der, som jeg vet at jeg slipper disse... Litt mer lugubre hotellene som du kan risikere å komme bort i.
Ja, nei, det er jo noe med det. Man vet jo aldri hvor hen man ender opp hen.
Sant.
Og det vet jo en god venn av oss, Ambrose Bierce.
Ja, Ambrose Bierce, ja. Ja, han var ute på reise selv, han da for så vidt og bare forsvant.
Ja, det er jo begynner å bli noen 10 år siden, så man kan jo med sikkerhet se at fyren er... avgått med døden nå. Han ville jo vært over 100.
Ja, det så galt blir det ikke, men han var jo noen av 70 når han strøk med, da.
Ja.
Men antageligvis strøk med.
Ja. Så, men han var en genial fyr da, og var journalist og skrev kortfortellinger og ja.
Og der opplegget han The Devil's Dictionary som vi har.
Åh, det liker vi jo så godt.
Det liker vi kjempegodt. Det er helt fantastisk.
Så det, ja, men i den forbindelse, når vi er nå ute og reiser og snakker om hotellet, og vi snakker om Ambrose Bierce, så er det en liten kortfortelling som jeg synes at vi bør høre. Og det er The Other Lodgers. Vi har faktisk hørt den en gang før, men den er faktisk ganske stilig, og den passer jo godt med temaet nå som vi er ute og, reiser.
Som en advarsel til... Ja, skrekk og advarsel.
Skrekk og advarsel, rett og slett. Ja, nei, men vi kan ta og høre den mens vi venter på at det her nye dieseltoget skal komme.
Ja.
Ja, vi gjør det.
The Other Lodgers by Ambrose Bierce. Reading by Bologna Times. In order to take that train, said Colonel Levering, sitting in the Waldorf Astoria Hotel, you will have to remain nearly all night in Atlanta. That is a fine city, but I advise you not to put up at the Breathitt House, one of the principal hotels. It is an old wooden building, in urgent need of repairs. There are breaches in the walls that you could throw a cat through. The bedrooms have no locks on the doors, no furniture but a single chair in each, and a bedstead without bedding. Just a mattress. Even these meager accommodations you cannot be sure that you will have in monopoly. You must take your chance of being stowed in with a lot of others. Sir, it is a most abominable hotel. The night that I passed in it was an uncomfortable night. I got in late and was shown to my room on the ground floor by an apologetic night clerk with a tallow candle, which he considerately left with me. I was worn out by 2 days and a night of hard railway travel, and had not entirely recovered from a gunshot wound in the head received in an altercation. Rather than look for better quarters, I lay down on the mattress without removing my clothing, and fell asleep. Along toward morning I awoke. The moon had risen, and was shining in at the uncurtained window, illuminating the room with a soft bluish light, which seemed, somehow, a bit spooky, though I dare say it had no uncommon quality. All moonlight is that way, if you will observe it. Imagine my surprise and indignation when I saw the floor occupied by at least a dozen of the lodgers. I sat up, earnestly damning the management of that unthinkable hotel, and was about to spring from the bed to go and make trouble for the night clerk, him of the apologetic manner and the tallow candle, when something in the situation affected me with a strange indisposition to move. I suppose I was what a story writer might call frozen with terror, for those men were obviously all dead. They lay on their backs, disposed orderly, along three sides of the room, their feet to the walls. Against the other wall, farthest from the door, stood my bed and the chair. All the faces were covered, but under their white cloths, the features of the two bodies that lay in the square patch of moonlight near the window showed in sharp profile as to nose and chin. I thought this a bad dream, and tried to cry out, as one does in a nightmare, but could make no sound. At last, with a desperate effort, I threw my feet to the floor, and passing between the two rows of clouted faces and the two bodies that lay nearest the door, I escaped from the infernal place and ran to the office. The night clerk was there, behind the desk, sitting in the dim light of another tallow candle, just sitting and staring. He did not rise. My abrupt entrance produced no effect upon him, though I must have looked a veritable corpse myself. It occurred to me then that I had not before really observed the fellow. He was a little chap, with a colorless face and the whitest, blankest eyes I ever saw. He had no more expression than the back of my hand. His clothing was a dirty gray. "Damn you," I said. "What do you mean?" Just the same, I was shaking like a leaf in the wind and did not recognize my own voice. The night clerk rose, bowed, apologetically, and, well, he was no longer there. And at that moment, I felt a hand upon my shoulder from behind. Just fancy that, if you can. Unspeakably frightened, I turned and saw a portly, kind-faced gentleman who asked, "What is the matter, my friend?" I was not long in telling him, but before I made an end of it, he went pale himself. "See here," he said, "are you telling the truth?" I had now got myself in hand, and terror had given place to indignation. "If you dare to doubt it," I said, "I'll hammer the life out of you." "No," he replied, "don't do that. Just sit down till I tell you. This is not a hotel. It used to be. Afterward, it was a hospital. Now it is unoccupied, awaiting a tenant. The room that you mentioned was a dead room. There were always plenty of dead. The fellow that you call the night clerk used to be that, but later he booked the patients as they were brought in. I don't understand his being here. He has been dead a few weeks." "And who are you?" I blurted out. "Oh, I look after the premises. I happened to be passing just now, and seeing a light in here, came in to investigate. Let us have a look into that room," he added, lifting the sputtering candle from the desk. "I'll see you at the devil first," said I, bolting out the door into the street. "Sir, that Breathitt House in Atlanta is a beastly place. Don't you stop there." "God forbid. Your account of it certainly does not suggest comfort. By the way, Colonel, when did all that occur?" "In September, 1864, shortly after the siege."
Thank you.
Du, Hans, har du fyrtøy?
Ja, vent litt, han skal stå sånn. Her har du fyrtøy.
Takk skal du ha, vet du. Skal se. Å få fyrt i pipa, vet du. Det er viktig å ha det på stell.
Ja, viktig å ha det på stell, ja. Tror jeg skal fortsette det sakte selvord da jeg kom på toget. Jeg tror det er best,
ja. Ja, nei, så lenge det er lov til å røyke på toget, så er det vel ikke nøye hva slags tog det er i og for seg.
Nei, sant det, altså. Verden kommer til å gå til helvete, men den dagen det ikke er lov å røyke på toget, altså. Det...
Ja, nei, det kommer ikke til å skje.
Nei, ikke søren. Det er egentlig ikke tåpelig som å si at det ikke er lov å røyke på en pub. Herregud, altså.
Ikke sant.
Det hadde jo... Det er jo helt umulig.
Men bare sånn, det har vi nettopp hørt på. Det var da An Empty Stage med... Kan du, husker du hva hun heter?
Lena Seljanja.
Seljanja, sånn var det, vet du.
Ja, Seljanja.
Så, ja. Spørsmål, hva du synes om det her at vi er fører på en tur?
Ja, det er jo litt sånn forskjellig fra å sitte i biblioteket og prate om det vi nettopp har lest, da.
Ja, men jeg liker biblioteket, og det er koselig, og det er varmt og godt, og på en måte, man vet jo alltid, ja.
Man vet hvor man har ting, altså det er lett å finne kaffen, til tross for at det er såkalt ikke eneste greiene å ordne med, jeg har litt rannet på jorda av og til, men ellers.
Ja, skal vi se.
Ja.
Ja, men det er...
Nei, det er så bra at vi kom oss ut på tur her, det var fint at du ble med.
Ja, nei... Du vet noe, jeg er noe litt skeptisk mot sånne her nyvinninger, og jeg er ikke noe spesielt glad i å fære utført Trondheim heller, egentlig. Det er liksom du som er den som pleier å fære på langtur.
Ja, det er jo det. Men du må gjøre litt også, det er jo klart det.
Ja, ja, det er ikke, men, noe, det er ikke noe gærlig det.
Nei, hvorfor er det du ikke synes det er noe stas å dra på tur forresten?
Nei, altså det har jo noe med det at når du kommer ifra en velstående familie, ikke sant? Så det er litt problematisk hvis du fær til en ny plass, og så, hvis det da plutselig skjer noe, og du ikke vet hvem du må på en måte ta kontakt med for å få ordnet ting, så på en måte puff, så havner du på første siden i aviser, eller noe sånt. Og det er jo bare hvis det ikke var noe gære som skjedde, at du ble rana, eller noe sånt. Det er jo alltid noen som er ute etter å ta dine ting.
Det er jo sånt, ja, sånn. Så det er jo sånn sett. Så.
Neida, men...
Det er jo mye ganger gærlig på tog, da, herlighet.
Nei,
ikke så mange rare mennesker som er med toget, kanskje.
Ja, jo, det er ganske mye rare folk, tror jeg. Jeg tenker sånn, du har sånne som oss, som nå færer med toget for å... Ja, rett og slett, vi har lyst til å se hvordan det er med det her nye toget.
Sant.
Den er grei. Da har du folk som skal gjøre det i forbindelse med arbeid. Det er jo helt kurant. Hardt arbeidende arbeidsfolk er helt kurant. Men så er det jo på en måte alle de som da færer til Oslo, fra Nordland, eller da Trondheimsregion, som da har et eller annet skjul. De flykter ifra heimplassene sine for å fære til Oslo, der det er stor by.
Sant det, altså. Det er mye mulighet i Oslo for en del folk ikke vil møte, egentlig.
Ja, så jeg er skeptisk til det. Men
det har jeg ikke tenkt på.
Ja, nei, det er derfor jeg er litt engstelig til sånn kollektivtrafikk i utgangspunktet. Men jeg skjønner at det er jo kommet for å bli liksom, og damplokomotiv er pen. Damplokomotiv er veldig pen.
Damplokomotiv er veldig pen, men det skal bli spennende å se hvordan den nye lokomotiv er, da.
Ja, ja da, det blir noe bra, det.
Hva er det der for noe?
Det er noe lyd. Jeg tror det er toget.
Herlighet er jo... Presist.
Ja, nei, men vi må vel kanskje ta på oss jakkene våre. Ja. Så.
Skal vi se hva sa den?
Skal vi se. Yes, nei, men vi får gå ut. Nå kommer det inn på perrongen her.
Oi! Nei, men se på det der, da, gitt!
Ja, nei, det var...
Dette var andre boller.
Ja, skal vi se.
Jeg liker deres damme borte, da.
Ja, jeg får gå bort og se litt på siden. Ja.
Gul og blått, for søren.
Gult og blått, det...
Svenske greier!
Ja, skulle tro det var Sverige vi var i nå.
Ja, det er jo Norge, det er jo litt tyske greier der, er det ikke det?
Ja, da, det kommer fra Tyskland, originalt sett, ja. Men ikke bare, så mekanikk kan de jo, det vet vi jo.
Stemmer,
ja. Men,
det er mye annet også, for så vidt.
Jeg synes det er rart, du ser på toget her, så ser du det. Det ser jo ut som to brød som de har tatt og klappet ihop. Det er jo ikke... De har jo ikke et eget look en gang.
Det er jo bare... spisevogn.
Nei, det er bare to loffer som er sett ihop.
Gul og blå loffer.
Gul og blå loffer. Skal vi se. Så, de, skikkelig rund. Det ligner på sånn veldig avrundet brødbokser.
Det er, jeg synes det så litt stas ut når det kommer her, men altså... Nei. Nei. Dette her er...
Skeptisk.
Skeptisk, ja.
Ja, nei, men...
Nei.
Men det er jo lov at det skal være mye bra inni, da.
Ja, det har lov til, ja.
Det er lov til at det skal være veldig bra inni, men...
Fida med å ha en spiseavdeling her, hvis ikke så går det her. Det går ikke her, altså.
Nei, men skal vi ta oss... Vi må vel komme oss inn på det. De venter vel ikke lenger på her.
Ja, nei,
men,
vi får komme oss inn på
det. Dere får høre på det her imens.
Not so many years ago, tomato soup and cream of tomato were unusual dishes, enjoyed very much, but not very often. Today, of all the soups in the world, tomato soup is the one most often served. Not because women have taken to making tomato soup frequently. No, on the contrary, few housewives ever attempt it anymore. There's just one reason for tomato soup's popularity, and it is this. The magic, matchless flavor of Campbell's tomato soup. There's a lively verve, a dashing zest about this flavor that people take to at once and come back to and enjoy again and again. The first racy taste of it has a way of arousing a desire to eat, and yet there's a pleasant feeling of satisfaction when the last spoonful is gone. So this soup is a happy choice for the main dish at lunchtime or at supper, and it also is a fine way to start the day's main meal. Serve it sometimes, too, as cream of tomato, made with milk instead of water. You can always be sure that it will be received with pleasure. Because this, of all soups, is the one people like to have most often. Campbell's tomato soup.
Ja,
ja. Ja. Seten er jo egentlig ganske komfortabel, men små da.
Ja.
Jeg liker ikke at folk så nær på meg.
Nei, jeg er ikke det. Men det er jo ganske stilt her.
Ja, å herlighet, de der stillegående maskiner her, altså, det der er jo ingenting.
Men det rister litt.
Kjenner... Her kommer til å få noen vanvittig vondt i ryggen, eller hva tror du da?
Ja, tror du det. Ja, nei, men jeg, ja, jeg var vel kanskje den som var mest negativ til det her i utgangspunktet.
Ja, jeg skal begynne å bli enig, altså, det var ikke... Nei, nei. Jeg har egentlig ikke... Nei, det er mye mangler her, altså.
Ja.
Det er det.
Men må vi ta oss en tur bort og se på det her vannklosett-tingen senere.
Vannklosett?
Vannklosett, ja, akkurat sånn som du har hjemme.
Oi, dæven!
Ja, det er jo det som er nytt. Dette er faktisk det første toget i Norge som har vannklosett på toget.
Det skal du få på to.
Men det kan vel hende at kongen og kongevogna har det.
Ja, kanskje. Men, det er jo litt spesielle tilfeller det da.
Ja, det er... Man kan liksom ikke spørre kongen, hei, kan jeg få låne togvogna di for at...
Det kan du jo, men du får nok ikke et ja.
Nei, det er noe der. Men, nei, men det var litt... Du har rett, altså du sa i sted, det var litt tett med setene her, synes jeg.
Ja, altså, ja, nei, se på de folkene som er presset sammen der, da.
Ja.
Der er jo fire søkker som sitter helt oppe hverandre omtrent.
Mm.
Nei, fysj, altså. Jeg er glad vi kjøpte, eller at vi har setene her for oss selv, altså.
Ja.
Det var bra.
Men,
Nei, det er ordfører til...
Den lukta det, og...
Ja, og ordfører står der som deles, altså.
Ja,
se på, da.
Står der, ja. Ja, nei, det er... Men altså, det er, sånn er det når man kommer litt ut på landet, så gjør folk sånne der type ting. Det er,
ja, ja, det er...
Det er ikke noe gærlig i det, men...
Nei, eller hvem vet?
Ja.
Hvem vet?
Men altså, det er jo et problem her. Altså, tenk om at det hadde vært... Nå er det jo faktisk bare... Faktisk bare voksne folk i denne vogna her. Men altså, tenk hvis det hadde vært en barnefamilie som kom med. Hva hvis de skulle flytte, for eksempel, og ha med seg alt pikkpakket sitt, og unger og alt sammen og sånt på toget?
Ja, tenk om det er noen som har med unge. Tenk om en unge begynner å skrike her, gitt.
Ja.
Å, herregud.
Det er jo nok bråk i toget og vibrasjonene og sånt.
Sant det.
Nei.
Uff, nei. Ja. Nei, det er...
Fantastisk.
Nei, de har et kjøkken her, da, hvis nok.
Ja, da.
Vi må inspisere det etter hvert.
Ja, og det er elektrisk fyrt kjøkken, står det.
Elektrisk fyrt?
Mm. Modell 88 motorvogn, for det er jo det kalles der. Det er i motorvogn.
Herlighet, det er.
Ja. De kaller noe alt så mye sunn nå for tiden.
Det er sære greier, altså.
Men det er elektrisk, da.
Ja, ja.
Som du så klart vet, så er jo de damplokomotivene, og vognen der er det jo koksfyrt.
Mm.
Og de har isboks og sånt. Men her har de faktisk strøm nok til å fyre, altså ha elektrisk fyre.
Men se på det folkene der, gitt. Nei.
Men det
er... Jeg ser rart på deg, tror jeg.
Ja, nei. Men det er kanskje for at vi snakket litt høyt om at de er rar.
Jeg fikk jo noe lommet også. Ja. Nei, jeg skal prøve. Jeg skal
men altså, det her det minner meg om en kar som jeg leste for noen år siden. Kalt selv for Saki.
Saki? Jo, han ja! Født litt sånn på slutten av 1860 til, eller kanskje var 1870 han ble fattig?
Ja.
Døde for ikke så alt for lenge siden.
Det, 1913 tror jeg. Han ble bare noen og 40, 45, 46, 40.
Ja, han døde i 1916 faktisk.
Skal vi se, Hector Hughes Munro.
Ja, det stemmer det. Jo, han var jo, han skrev en del ganske morsomme og eller makabre kortfortellinger som parodier og kommentarer på det britiske samfunnet.
Ja, men jeg mener å huske at han hadde en kortfortelling om hvordan det var å bli plaget på tog.
Ja, du tenker sikkert på The Storyteller.
The Storyteller, der har du den, vet du. Men kanskje vi skal ta oss og se om vi ikke kan kjøre den.
Ja, det kan
vi
gjøre.
Kanskje prøve å få brukt opp litt tid, sånn at vi slipper å forholde oss til de folkene her.
Ja, la oss gjøre det.
Da tror vi er det.
The Storyteller, from Beasts and Superbeasts, by Saki. It was a hot afternoon, and the railway carriage was correspondingly sultry, and the next stop was at Templecombe, nearly an hour ahead. The occupants of the carriage were a small girl, and a smaller girl, and a small boy. An aunt, belonging to the children, occupied one corner seat, and the further corner seat on the opposite side was occupied by a bachelor who was a stranger to their party. But the small girls and the small boy emphatically occupied the compartment. Both the aunt and the children were conversational in a limited, persistent way, reminding one of the attentions of a housefly that refused to be discouraged. Most of the aunt's remarks seemed to begin with "Don't!" and nearly all of the children's remarks began with "Why?" The bachelor said nothing out loud. "Don't, Cyril, don't!" exclaimed the aunt, as the small boy began smacking the cushions of the seat, producing a cloud of dust at each blow. "Come and look out of the window," she added. The child moved reluctantly to the window. "Why are those sheep being driven out of that field?" he asked. "I expect they're being driven to another field, where there's more grass," said the aunt weakly. "But there's lots of grass in that field," protested the boy. "There's nothing else but grass there. Aunt, there's lots of grass in that field." "Perhaps the grass in the other field is better," suggested the aunt, fatuously. "Why is it better?" came the swift, inevitable question. "Oh, look at those cows," exclaimed the aunt. Nearly every field along the line had contained cows or bullocks, but she spoke as though she were drawing attention to a rarity. "Why is the grass in the other field better?" persisted Cyril. The frown on the bachelor's face was deepening to a scowl. He was a hard, unsympathetic man, the aunt decided in her mind. She was utterly unable to come to any satisfactory decision about the grass in the other field. The smaller girl created a diversion by beginning to recite "On the Road to Mandalay." She only knew the first line, but she put her limited knowledge to the fullest possible use. She repeated the line over and over again in a dreamy but resolute and very audible voice. It seemed to the bachelor as though someone had had a bet with her that she could not repeat the line aloud 2,000 times without stopping. Whoever it was who had made the wager was likely to lose his bet. "Come over here and listen to a story," said the aunt, when the bachelor had looked twice at her and once at the communication cord. The children moved listlessly toward the aunt's end of the carriage. Evidently, her reputation as a storyteller did not rank high in their estimation. In a low, confidential voice, interrupted at frequent intervals by loud, petulant questions from her listeners, she began an unenterprising and deplorably uninteresting story about a little girl who was good, and made friends with everyone on account of her goodness, and was finally saved from a mad bull by a number of rescuers who admired her moral character. "'Wouldn't they have saved her if she hadn't been good?' demanded the bigger of the small girls. It was exactly the question that the bachelor had wanted to ask. "'Well, yes,' admitted the aunt lamely, "'but I don't think they would have run quite so fast to help her "'if they had not liked her so much.' "'It's the stupidest story I've ever heard,' said the bigger of the small girls with immense conviction. "'I didn't listen after the first bit. It was so stupid,' said Cyril. The smaller girl made no actual comment on the story, but she had long ago recommenced a murmured repetition of her favourite line. "'You don't seem to be much success as a storyteller,' said the bachelor suddenly from his corner. The aunt bristled in instant defence at this unexpected attack. "'It's a very difficult thing to tell stories that children can both understand and appreciate,' she said stiffly. "'I don't agree with you,' said the bachelor. "'Perhaps you would like to tell them a story,' was the aunt's retort. "'Tell us a story,' demanded the bigger of the small girls. "'Once upon a time,' began the bachelor, "'there was a little girl called Bertha, who was extraordinarily good.' The children's momentarily aroused interest began at once to flicker. All stories seemed dreadfully alike, no matter who told them. She did all that she was told. She was always truthful. She kept her clothes clean, ate milk puddings as though they were jam tarts, learned her lessons perfectly, and was polite in her manners. "Was she pretty?" asked the bigger of the small girls. "'Not as pretty as any of you,' said the bachelor. "'But she was horribly good.' There was a wave of reaction in favour of the story. The word horrible in connection with goodness was a novelty that commended itself. It seemed to introduce a ring of truth that was absent from the aunt's tales of infant life. "'She was so good,' continued the bachelor, "'that she won several medals for goodness, "'which she always wore pinned on to her dress. "'There was a medal for obedience, "'another medal for punctuality, "'and a third for good behaviour. "'They were large metal medals, "'and they clicked against one another as she walked. "'No other child in the town where she lived "'had as many as three medals, "'so everyone knew that she must be an extra good child.' "'Horribly good,' quoted Cyril. "'Everybody talked about her goodness, "'and the prince of the country got to hear about it, "'and he said that as she was so very good, "'she might be allowed once a week to walk in his park, "'which was just outside the town. "'It was a beautiful park, and no children were ever allowed in it, "'so it was a great honour for Bertha to be allowed to go there. "'Were there any sheep in the park?' demanded Cyril. "No," said the bachelor, "there were no sheep." "Why weren't there any sheep?" came the inevitable question arising out of that answer. The aunt permitted herself a smile which might almost have been described as a grin. "There were no sheep in the park," said the bachelor, "because the prince's mother had once had a dream that her son would either be killed by a sheep or else by a clock falling on him. For that reason the prince never kept a sheep in his park or a clock in his palace." The aunt suppressed a gasp of admiration. "Was the prince killed by a sheep or by a clock?" asked Cyril. "He's still alive, so we can't tell whether the dream will come true," said the bachelor unconcernedly. "Anyway, there were no sheep in the park, but there were lots of little pigs running around all over the place." "What colour were they?" "Black with white faces, white with black spots, black all over, grey with white patches, and some were white all over." The storyteller paused to let a full idea of the park's treasures sink into the children's imaginations, and then he resumed. "Bertha was rather sorry to find that there were no flowers in the park. She had promised her aunts, with tears in her eyes, that she would not pick any of the kind prince's flowers, and she had meant to keep her promise. So, of course, it made her feel rather silly to find that there were no flowers to pick." "Why weren't there any flowers?" "Because the pigs had eaten them all," said the bachelor promptly. The gardeners had told the prince that you couldn't have pigs and flowers, so he decided to have pigs and no flowers. There was a murmur of approval at the excellence of the prince's decision. So many people would have decided the other way. There were lots of delightful things in the park. There were ponds with gold and blue and green fish in them, and trees with beautiful parrots that said clever things at a moment's notice, and hummingbirds that hummed all the popular tunes of the day. Bertha walked up and down and enjoyed herself immensely, and thought to herself, "If I were not so extraordinarily good, I should not have been allowed to come into this beautiful park and enjoy all that there is to be seen in it." And her three medals clinked against one another as she walked, and helped to remind her how very good she really was. Just then an enormous wolf came prowling into the park to see if it could catch a fat little pig for its supper. "What colour was it?" asked the children, amid an immediate quickening of interest. "Mud colour all over, with a black tongue and pale grey eyes that gleamed with unspeakable ferocity. The first thing that it saw in the park was Bertha. Her pinafore was so spotlessly white and clean that it could be seen from a great distance. Bertha saw the wolf, and saw that it was stealing towards her, and she began to wish that she had never been allowed to come into the park. She ran as hard as she could, and the wolf came after her with huge leaps and bounds. She managed to reach a shrubbery of myrtle bushes, and she hid herself in one of the thickest of the bushes. The wolf came sniffing among the branches, its black tongue lolling out of its mouth and its pale grey eyes glaring with rage. Bertha was terribly frightened, and thought to herself, "If I had not been so extraordinarily good, I should have been safe in the town at this moment." However, the scent of the myrtle was so strong that the wolf could not sniff out where Bertha was hiding, and the bushes were so thick that he might have hunted about in them for a long time without catching sight of her, so he thought he might as well go off and catch a little pig instead. Bertha was trembling very much at having the wolf prowling and sniffing so near her, and as she trembled, the medal for obedience clinked against the medals for good conduct and punctuality. The wolf was just moving away when he heard the sound of the medals clinking and stopped to listen. They clinked again in a bush quite near him. He dashed into the bush, his pale grey eyes gleaming with ferocity and triumph, and dragged Bertha out and devoured her to the last morsel. All that was left of her were her shoes, bits of clothing, and the three medals for goodness. "Were any of the little pigs killed?" "No, they all escaped." "The story began badly," said the smaller of the small girls, "but it had a beautiful ending." "It is the most beautiful story that I ever heard," said the bigger of the small girls with immense decision. "It is the only beautiful story I have ever heard," said Cyril. A dissentient opinion came from the aunt. "A most improper story to tell young children. You have undermined the effect of years of careful teaching." "At any rate," said the bachelor, collecting his belongings preparatory to leaving the carriage, "I kept them quiet for 10 minutes, which is more than you were able to do." "Unhappy woman," he observed to himself as he walked down the platform of Templecombe Station. "For the next 6 months or so, those children will assail her in public with demands for an improper story."
Hans?
Ja, ja.
Vokten.
Ja, ja, ja.
Se, de slår nettopp på lysene.
Oi! Hvem skulle du sett?
Det begynner å bli mørkt, vet du. Det er ikke så langt igjen til Trondheim nå, så.
Kunne du tatt med en bok og lest, vet du?
Ja, det er jo veldig kjekt. En fin måte å bruke tida på når man er ute og reiser.
Ja. Men du, jeg hadde den mest absurde drømmen noensinne.
Ja, fortell.
Jeg drømte at vi tok båt til statene.
Ja, det tror jeg bare blir med drømmen, tror jeg. Jeg tror ikke jeg kommer til å ta båt over til statene.
Nei, hvorfor ikke? Jeg vil forlåte å fly, at jeg kan... Ja,
ja fly er jo kanskje, men du vet jo, altså, hvis noe skulle skje med meg midt ut på havet,
ja.
Så vi, altså, de kan jo ikke da ta med mine levninger til land. De tar jo da og gravlegger dem ute på havet, og det er jo, altså, det er jo ikke vikslet.
Nei, ja, sant det, altså, det kan jo risikere å få ganske mye styggdom ut av det.
Ja, med tanke på alt det vi har lest, så tar jeg ikke sjanser selv om at det vi har lest det er skjønnlitteratur.
Nei, sant nok. Kanskje det har du gjort det.
Så det.
Men du, for eksempel ta med et digert fat konjakk, sånn som Admiral Nelson gjorde, så kan du bli bedt om å bli dumpet i det.
Ja, det er, men da er det jo en, ikke det igjen, upraktisk og dyrt. Da kan du heller ta fly.
Sant.
Så, men der er du enda lavere standard da.
Ja, huff.
Ikke det, jeg har hørt noen som har funnet opp noe nytt faktisk, i Skottland.
Jaså?
Ja, det, for når de flyr fra Skottland over til statene, så var det en som fant på noe de kalt for Irish coffee. Så de ga passasjerene før de gikk ombord i flyet.
Jaså?
Ja, ja, kaffe og jeg tror det konjakk. Jeg litt usikker, men det i hvert fall kaffe og spiritus.
Nice. Blandet.
Ja,
det er kille.
Kille. Men apropos når vi snakket nå om å dø på åpent hav, Robert Barr, har du hørt om han?
Ja, ja. Det er også en folk som har født litt sånn nærheten av midten på 1800-tallet og døde for et par ti år siden.
Ja. Han var faktisk fra Glasgow, Skottland.
Ja, så?
Ja, og han laget flere korthistorier, blant annet en som heter The Man Who Was Not On The Passenger List.
Ja, så?
Så det tenkte jeg, nå mens vi rullet inn imot Trondheim, så kunne vi ta oss og høre på den.
Mm-hmm.
Men bare før vi startet, det er greien som vi har hørt i kveld. Det kommer fra LibreVox.
Ja, LibreVox er greinsteknikk, noe vi snakker om det.
Ja, det er interwebben.
Ja.
Så LibreVox, og så var det punktumtegn, O-R-G, var det?
Hva det måtte bety.
Ja, og så, ja, det du hørte på var Horror Night på Radio Revolt. Studentradion i Trondheim. Du kunne, dere går an til å sende oss mail på horrornight i et ord, og så sånn snabel A.
Sånn rar A.
Snabel A. Så det var det teknikeren sa det var heter, snabel A. Og så Radio Revolt i et ord igjen, og så punktum NO.
Right.
Så, ja, nei, men vi kommer tilbake neste veka.
Sannsynligvis.
Satser på det. Så da... Nå når vi begynner å nærme oss, får vi høre The Man Who Was Not On The Passenger List.
The Man Who Was Not On The Passenger List by Robert Barr. The well-sworn lie, frank to the world with all the circumstance of proof, cringes abashed and sneaks along the wall at the first sight of truth. The Gibrontus of the Hot Cross Bun Line was at one time the best ship of that justly celebrated fleet. All steamships have, of course, their turn at the head of the fleet until a better boat is built, but the Gibrontus is even now a reasonably fast and popular boat. An accident happened on board the Gibrontus some years ago, which was of small importance to the general public, but of some moment to Richard Keeling, for it killed him. The poor man got only a line or two in the papers when the steamer arrived at New York, and then they spelled his name wrong. It had happened something like this. Keeling was wandering around very late at night, when he should have been in his bunk, and he stepped on a dark place that he thought was solid. As it happened, there was nothing between him and the bottom of the hold but space. They buried Keeling at sea, and the officers knew absolutely nothing about the matter when inquisitive passengers, hearing rumours, questioned them. This state of things very often exists both on sea and land, as far as officials are concerned. Mrs. Keeling, who had been left in England while her husband went to America to make his fortune, and tumbled down a hole instead, felt aggrieved at the company. The company said that Keeling had no business to be nosing around dark places on the deck at that time of night, and doubtless their contention was just. Miss Keeling, on the other hand, held that a steamer had no right to have such man-traps open at any time, night or day, without having them properly guarded, and in that she was also probably correct. The company was very sorry, of course, that the thing had occurred, but they refused to pay for Keeling unless compelled to do so by the law of the land, and there matters stood. No one can tell what the law of the land will do when it's put in motion, although many people thought that if Mrs. Keeling had brought a suit against the Hot Cross Bun Company, she would have won it. But Mrs. Keeling was a poor woman, and you have to put a penny in the slot when you want the figures of justice to work, so the unfortunate creature signed something which the lawyer of the company had written out, and accepted the few pounds which Keeling had paid for room 18 on the Gibrontus. It would seem that this ought to have settled the matter, for the lawyer told Mrs. Keeling he thought the company acted very generously in refunding the passage money. But it didn't settle the matter. Within a year from that time, the company voluntarily paid Mrs. Keeling £2,100 for her husband. Now that the occurrence is called to your mind, you will perhaps remember the editorial one of the leading London dailies had on the extraordinary circumstance, in which it was very ably shown that the old saying about corporations having no souls to be condemned or bodies to be kicked did not apply in these days of commercial honour and integrity. It was a very touching editorial, and it caused tears to be shed on the Stock Exchange, the members having had no idea, before reading it, that they were so noble and generous. How, then, was it that the Hot Cross Bun Company did this commendable act when their lawyer took such pains to clear them of all legal liability? The purser of the Gibrontus, who is now old and superannuated, could probably tell you if he liked. When the negotiations with Mrs. Keeling had been brought to a satisfactory conclusion by the lawyer of the company, and when that gentleman was rubbing his hands over his easy victory, the good ship Gibrontus was steaming out of the Mersey on her way to New York. The stewards in the Grand Saloon were busy getting things in order for dinner, when a wan and gaunt passenger spoke to one of them. "Where have you placed me at table?" he asked. "What name, sir?" asked the steward. "Keeling." The steward looked along the main tables, up one side and down the other, reading the cards, but nowhere did he find the name he was in search of. Then he looked at the small tables, but also without success. "How do you spell it, sir?" he asked the patient passenger. "K-E-E-L-I-N-G. "Thank you, sir." Then he looked up and down the four rows of names on the passenger list he held in his hand, but finally shook his head. "I can't find your name on the passenger list," he said. "I'll speak to the purser, sir." "I wish you would," replied the passenger in a listless way, as if he had not much interest in the matter. The passenger, whose name was not on the list, waited until the steward returned. "Would you mind stepping into the purser's room for a moment, sir? I'll show you the way, sir." When the passenger was shown into the purser's room, that official said to him, in the urbane manner of pursers, "Might I look at your ticket, sir?" The passenger pulled a long pocketbook from the inside of his coat, opened it, and handed the purser the document it contained. The purser scrutinized it sharply, and then referred to a list he had on the desk before him. "This is very strange," he said at last. "I never knew such a thing to occur before, although, of course, it is always possible. The people on shore have in some unaccountable manner left your name out of my list. I am sorry you have been put to any inconvenience, sir." "There has been no inconvenience so far," said the passenger, "and I trust there will be none. You find the ticket regular, I presume?" "Quite so, quite so," replied the purser. Then, to the waiting steward, "Give Mr. Keeling any place he prefers at the table which is not already taken. You have room 18. "That was what I bought at Liverpool." "Well, I see you have the room to yourself, and I hope you'll find it comfortable. Have you ever crossed with us before, sir? I seem to recollect your face."
"I've never been in America."
"Ah, I see so many faces, of course, that I sometimes fancy I know a man when I don't. Well, I hope you'll have a pleasant voyage, sir."
"Thank you."
Number 18 was not a popular passenger. People seemed instinctively to shrink from him, although it must be admitted that he made no advances. All went well until the Gibrontus was about halfway over. One forenoon, the chief officer entered the captain's room with a pale face, and, shutting the door after him, said,
I am very sorry to have to report, sir, that one of the passengers has fallen into the hold. Good heavens, cried the captain. Is he hurt? He is killed, sir. The captain stared aghast at his subordinate. How did it happen? I gave the strictest orders. Those places were on no account to be left unguarded. Although the company had held to Mrs. Keeling that the captain was not to blame, their talk with that gentleman was of an entirely different tone. That is a strange part of it, sir. The hatch has not been opened this voyage, sir, and was securely bolted down. Nonsense! Nobody will believe such a story. Someone has been careless. Ask the purser to come here, please. When the purser saw the body, he recollected, and came as near fainting as a purser can. They dropped Keeling overboard in the night, and the whole affair was managed so quietly that nobody suspected anything, and, what is the most incredible thing in this story, the New York papers did not have a word about it. What the Liverpool office said about the matter nobody knows, but it must have stirred up something like a breeze in that strictly business locality. It is likely they pooh-poohed the whole affair, for, strange to say, when the purser tried to corroborate the story with the dead man's ticket, the document was nowhere to be found. The Gibraltar started out on her next voyage from Liverpool with all her colours flying, but some of her officers had a vague feeling of unrest within them, which reminded them of the time they first sailed on the heaving seas. The purser was seated in his room, busy, as pursers always are at the beginning of a voyage, when there was a rap at the door. "Come in!" shouted the important official, and there entered unto him a stranger, who said, "Are you the purser?" "Yes, sir. What can I do for you?" "I have room number 18. "What?" cried the purser with a gasp, almost jumping from his chair. Then he looked at the robust man before him, and sank back with a sigh of relief. It was not Keeling. "I have room number 18, continued the passenger, "and the arrangement I made with your people in Liverpool was that I was to have the room to myself. I do a great deal of shipping over your..." "Yes, my dear sir," said the purser, after having looked rapidly over his list. "You have number 18 to yourself." "So I told the man who was unpacking his luggage there, but he showed me his ticket, and it was issued before mine. I can't quite understand why your people should..." "What kind of a looking man is he?" "A thin, unhealthy, cadaverous man, who doesn't look as if he would last till the voyage ends. I don't want him for a roommate, if I have to have one. I think you ought..." "I will, sir. I will make it all right. I suppose, if it should happen that a mistake has been made, and he has the prior claim to the room, you would not mind taking number 24. It is a larger and better room." "That will suit me exactly." So the purser locked his door, and went down to number 18. "Well?" he said to its occupant. "Well," answered Mr. Keeling, looking up at him with his cold and fishy eyes. "You're here again, are you?" "I'm here again, and I will be here again, and again, and again, and again, and again." "Now, what the..." Then the purser hesitated a moment, and thought perhaps he had better not swear, with that icy, clammy gaze fixed upon him. "What object have you in all this?" "Object? The very simple one of making your company live up to its contract. From Liverpool to New York, my ticket reads. I paid for being landed in the United States, not for being dumped overboard in mid-ocean. Do you think you can take me over? You've had 2 tries at it, and have not succeeded. Yours is a big and powerful company, too. If you know we can't do it, then why do you..." The purser hesitated. "Pester you with my presence?" suggested Mr. Keeling. "Because I want you to do justice. £2,000 is the prize, and I will raise it £100 every trip." This time, the New York papers got hold of the incident, but not of its peculiar features. They spoke of the extraordinary carelessness of the officers in allowing practically the same accident to occur twice on the same boat. When the Gibraltar reached Liverpool, all the officers, from the captain down, sent in their resignations. Most of the sailors did not take the trouble to resign, but cut for it. The managing director was annoyed at the newspaper comments, but laughed at the rest of the story. He was invited to come over and interview Keeling for his own satisfaction, most of the officers promising to remain on the ship if he did so. He took room 18 himself. What happened, I do not know. For the purser refused to sail again on the Gibraltar, and was given another ship. But this much is certain. When the managing director got back, the company generously paid Mrs. Keeling £2,100.